An absolute delight. Yeah, it's good. I mean, from a keyboard point of view, just so you're aware, I kicked a chair over the other night and broke two keys off it. So I have been playing without an F and a C,
Oh.
which would put a lot of keyboard-based comedians off. So I transposed up into F sharp, but now I've just glued them back on. So I think we're going to be back down again for Sydney.
It's been a really bizarre year. Donald Trump remains the president of the United States. Australia's been changing prime ministers. In last year's show, you said the only people that seem to be happy at the moment are racists and the makers of specialty gin. Has much changed in the last year?
I mean, it's a slightly different vibe here. I know you've got your election coming up, but in Ireland, there's a kind of existential threat to life caused by Brexit and such craziness happening across Europe. So it is strange. Like, Brexit is, I think if you don't know about Brexit, any of your listeners, Brexit will be like standing on the roof of your house, calling all of your neighbors dickheads individually and then not moving, just continuing to live there. So it's a strange time, I think, for all of us.
It must be wall-to-wall coverage at the moment in the United Kingdom. I mean, just endless talk of this leaving the union, talk about Irish backstop. So what are your observations on the sort of British soap opera?
Yeah, I mean, it's Ireland has always been something of a mystery for them. You know, although they're technically responsible for Northern Ireland, it seems like a lot of them forgot that when they were voting. It's kind of England breaking away from the rest of it. It just seems like such an overreaction. It's like, it reminds me of when I was 8. I once counted the number of days to my birthday, and it was more than I thought. And I was so angry, I punched the calendar and broke my hand. It's that sort of an overreaction.
England sort of has always had that sort of thing with Europe of having an island mentality, but this is even stranger. It's sort of half an island sort of mentality. It just, yeah.
Yeah, it used to be funny, to be honest. I was getting a good laugh out of it up until about 3 months ago, you know, because they were literally just all marching around England, chanting Churchill's name, setting things on fire. But now you remember that we're the neighbours and the smoke is starting to come under our curtains. So it's a good time to be in Australia, is what I'm saying.
Much calming, even in the middle of an election campaign.
Australian politics is strange because I sort of dip into it once in a while when I'm at home, and it's normally vaguely similar. You know, someone from Queensland has said something crazy, and the Labour Party and the Liberals have new leaders. Australian politics, I always think it's kind of like taking a dump in a port-a-loo at a festival that's blocked, but you go anyway. And then as you leave, someone else is coming in, and you say, "It was pretty much like that when I got there." It always seems to be vaguely similar.
So, according to the Irish Times, there's like been like about 300,000 requests now for Irish citizenship. So, have we got this kind of dynamic now, like reverse immigration, where suddenly like Irish citizenship is now in demand?
Yeah, what's funny about the Brexit, a lot of the Brexiteer big leaders, a lot of the sort of top hat wearing Victorian ghosts, it turns out they have an Irish grandparent. So they're all getting Irish passports and then they're relocating their businesses to Ireland so they can stay in the EU. So I'm all in favor. It's still the most sparsely populated country in Europe. So if it gets too tricky in Australia, if it gets too hot with global warming, why not come back and live in some of the less fashionable counties? Cavan, Leitrim is crying out for people to play on their local Gaelic football teams.
I've got actual friends that are like saying, "Oh, I'd like to actually work out how to get Irish citizenship." You don't have some sort of grandma where we can sort of connote some sort of, "Oh, yeah." There's a distant O'Doherty relation.
I think there's always a danger. I have an Aussie friend who just had a. You need one grandparent to apply for an Irish passport, and she applied at the Irish Embassy in Sydney, and they said, "Yeah, passport will be fine, but you do realize there is an outstanding arrest warrant for your grandfather because he was dead for 50 years." But it turned out, I think he'd done a runner from his Irish family and just come to Sydney and started the whole thing over again. So that is the danger of getting an Irish passport as an Australian.
So now you've still got your faithful companion, the 1986 Yamaha. So what's it at? 15, 20 years? Still remains an important part of your act. Have you ever thought of like switching instruments? You know, going to a guitar or a sitar, ukulele. I mean, ukulele is maybe a little bit too over.
Yeah, too done. No, I feel that people go to a Tim Minchin concert because they want to hear beautiful songs played beautifully on a beautiful Steinway. But no one ever comes to one of my gigs to hear beautiful songs. So I think from a transportation point of view, from a keyboard rental point of view, the beauty of being able to carry your instrument around in a sports bag and, if needs be, throw it in the river at the end of a tour and just buy a new one on eBay. That's the advantage I have over Tim.
So you'd never go for like the extravaganza, like the sort of Rick Wakeman on ice thing where you have David O'Doherty on ice where you have like this like thousands of people and like people moving around. It was always going to be like lo-fi.
I think from a sound check point of view, if I'm doing a gig at 8, I like to be able to get into the venue at about 6, you know, have a nice dinner and then do a sound check. The idea of getting in there at 3 in the afternoon and having to set up my big Rick Wakeman rig, I think I'll stick with the little one for the moment. I can play the piano a bit, but I feel it doesn't add much comedically to my songs. My dad's a piano player, and he's proper, so I think I'll leave the piano to him.
And you've always had a few jokes about guitars, about Guitar Hero and Air Guitar. There doesn't seem to be a sort of keyboard equivalent. Like, there's not really a keyboard keyboard hero. I mean, no one really plays like Air Rachmaninoff.
I will say this, it has happened a few times on tour that the keyboard I'm playing just dies for whatever reason. And pawn shops, you know, in the dodgiest part of your city are always the place to go. And they nearly always have 5 of those tiny keyboards that I love in them. It seems like when your life hits the skids, you look around your apartment and the very first thing you decide to sell is your tiny plastic keyboard from the late 80s.
So you've got a new show, Ultrasound. Can you tell us just a little bit about this theme? What are you diagnosing the world ills? What's Ultrasound about?
Well, it's that old problem whereby I was definitely going to fix everything that was wrong with the world. I was going to at last just capture the essence of the human condition. People would leave my venue after the show feeling like, yeah, I know, I understand everything now. Now, unfortunately, along the way, that's gone awry. And now it's mostly about my obsession with bicycles. But I think, in a way, bicycles could be the secret to everything. So, yeah, I'm not denying that it's not going to fix everything. It's just not in the way I expected.
So this is kind of saying, I mean, you're called by The Guardian, the Irish whimsy merchant. Can you tell us a little bit about this moniker? I know Bill Bailey calls himself the Earl of Whimsy. I don't know if you've got like a hereditary title where that's sort of handed on or anything. You can do that when you're a Brit. So what is what's whimsy? I mean, yeah, as a sort of comedic genre.
Yeah, I've never quite been sure. I think, you know, when you get reviewed, if the journalist sees you wearing a leather jacket and shouting a lot, they're like, oh, this is serious, this is political. But, you know, even if you're talking about the most serious stuff in your life, the fact that you're sitting beside a small plastic keyboard from the 80s means they're like, ah, yeah, this is just whimsy, that's all this is. But, you know, it used to annoy me a lot, but nah, it's fine. You can call it whatever you want, really. I'm just trying to stuff a load of jokes as close to each other as possible.
So in Australia, as I said, we have an election at the moment, so there's lots of stunts, name-calling. Probably one of the most bizarre things was a few weeks ago, the anti-immigration party, One Nation, got busted on camera trying to solicit donations from the National Rifle Association.
Yeah,
and so their excuse apparently to this was apparently they were on the source, which just means they had a big, big night out on the drink. So I was wondering, are there any examples you could think of, like, of drunkenness on camera, which sort of mixes? I mean, you've never sort of gone to the United States after a big night of drinks and gone, oh, I'll try and solicit $20 million from the National Rifle Association.
It's funny, in Ireland at the moment, there's the very start of a right-wing White Ireland party, which just, and it's on, I think it's on 0.01% at the moment, because the idea of trying to start a White Ireland party, which has been traditionally the whitest country in the world ever, and was also the worst place in the world. Like, we really tried White Ireland for about 2,000 years there, and it's why half of the country ended up in Australia, to be honest. So I don't think it's going to get any sort of level of support, but to blame it on the drink, well, maybe they're just drunk all the time then.
I mean, we like a drink at that, but I mean, I had a cousin, and I always like this cousin story. Was we always had a good night, we were drinking with him, and I remember going out and saying, oh yeah, I saw this. I went out and we had a good night drink. You could see he was pretty hungover. And oh, you saw the L-shaped pool table, and we're like, oh yeah, bullshit. And of course, next day you walk past it, and just anticlimactic, the whole sort of story. Sort of, it was actually what did exist. So it was kind of disappointing. It's kind of like the sort of alien story where, you know, you know, if the green men actually turned up, you'd be kind of a bit of a letdown, actually.
Yeah, I mean, you can blame it I guess you can blame some things on it. I always like the tale of, so my favorite writer was a guy called Flann O'Brien.
Oh yeah, fabulous, yeah.
Amazing Irish writer who was once, he was a civil servant by day, and there was a rule in the civil service that you couldn't go to the pub during the hours of work. And he was holed up before a tribunal in work, and they said you were seen going into Convall's Lounge at 10 a.m., and he said, I don't deny this. I just deny the way it's being put to me. I wasn't seen going in. I was seen coming in. The implication being someone from his work was already in there, one of the bosses probably, and the case was quickly dropped. So I think you can use your brain a lot to get out of these accusations.
So tell us a little bit about your comedic influences. Who were the ones that you learned a lot about?
Yeah, my dad is a jazz musician, and there's always a weird tie-in between particularly like 60s American hipster comedy and jazz, because they played in a lot of the same clubs. You've got Lenny Bruce would be mm-hmm. the famous one, and then people like Lord Buckley. And then that sort of moved into a lot of British stuff that my granny lived on an island off the West Coast, so we'd have this 6-hour drive that we'd do like 8 times a year. So he would have these tapes that he would play of strange old BBC comedy, like shows like Round the Horn and the Monty Python albums, and then bits and pieces of stand-up. There was early stuff by people like Stuart Lee and Kevin McAleer and these sort of seminal British and Irish comedians of the new wave. So I don't know, when I figured out that I was a terrible jazz musician, it wasn't that huge a leap then to move into the other kind of beloved family business. So I think a lot of it came from my dad through that sort of classic canon. And then I was lucky enough, when I started, my first Edinburgh was where I did a solo show, was in 2002. And in the venue after me were Flight of the Conchords. So I ended up playing piano in their show, which is funny because we toured the UK then in 2004 playing to between 12 and 15 people. And then last year we did an arena tour playing to like 15,000 a night. So if you stick at it for long enough, you'll build a crowd eventually.
And also, just finally, how do you, I mean, just from watching Would I Lie to You, and how do you succeed in keeping a straight face for so long? When I've got those jokes, I'm just like, it takes like 30 seconds, but you seem to be able to keep it quite straight for quite a while because I'm, yeah.
I think I might be the worst ever contestant on Would I Lie to You, and they know that now, so they give me some astonishing nonsense, and I pretend to cry. So my way to get out of laughing is I pretend that the whole thing has been too emotional for me, and I just start weeping, but I don't think anyone falls for that anymore. So the answer is very, very badly.
Well, thank you for being on the show, David. It was a real pleasure chatting to you again.
That's a delight. Anytime.